This podcast is available thanks to the Access Internet Radio Project, funded by New Zealand On Air. Nice one.
Good evening, I'm Lois Griffiths. This evening, Martin and I are delighted to be interviewing Australian writer and investigative journalist Anthony Lerenstein. We plan to discuss another Australian, Julian Assange, and most important, the phenomenon of WikiLeaks.
We hope, too, to say something about Bradley Manning and, in general, the role of whistleblowers in providing information to the public. So welcome to Earthwise, Anthony Lerenstein.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Anthony, you've written in your blog, WikiLeaks is one of the biggest and most important stories in the world, challenging governments and journalists alike. How is it challenging journalists?
I think one of the important and most revealing things about WikiLeaks, and WikiLeaks started in 2006. Most people didn't maybe hear about it until a few years ago, but it's been going now for 6 years or so, is that it forces many journalists, particularly in the corporate world, to think about why they didn't get the information that WikiLeaks received. And what I mean by that is that WikiLeaks is a small organization run initially by a few people, the head being Julian Assange. And as he said numerous times over the years, why have we, as a small organization, received more leaks and more information than all the corporate media combined for the last 30 years? And it's a very interesting question. And I think, although there are obviously many mainstream journalists who are doing very fine work in many countries, the truth is, and I think WikiLeaks reveals this, and it's something I've written about myself, is that for too many journalists, they see their role not as questioning power, but as enabling power. They want to be close to power. And the danger in that is, of course, that you miss, willfully miss, a great deal of information because it might embarrass or shame power. And I think the best example of that happening in the last decade has been the run-up to the Iraq War in 2003, where clearly there were many dissenting voices who were saying that Iraq did not have WMDs and we should not invade Iraq for legal reasons and moral reasons. And yet the vast majority of the corporate press went along with the war and supported and amplified government lies. This is Britain, America, Australia, and elsewhere. So WikiLeaks, I think, is a vital and important tool, and any websites like it, because it challenges that kind of unhealthy relationship.
In fact, I think in Washington press conferences, the officials know all the reporters by name, or they just invite people they know by name. It's very much embedded.
Well, that's the kind of dynamic that unfortunately exists in the White House press corps, but it also exists in many parliamentary systems. I'm sure it's the same in New Zealand. I know it's the same in Australia. It's the same certainly in the UK. And I'm not arguing that journalists shouldn't, for example, know people they're speaking to. I mean, it's the nature to some extent of that power relationship. The problem is that in many parliamentary systems or so-called democracies like America, the journalists and the politicians don't see themselves as opponents. They see themselves as friends. And I think a good example of that was last weekend, where there is something every year called the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which is hosted by the U.S. President, this time, of course, Barack Obama. And this is really a fun, wonderful event that journalists go to sit next to politicians, laugh, joke about, etc. Now, the reason this, to me, is fundamentally problematic is that the true role of a journalist is not to be friendly or matey with politicians. It is to criticize them and challenge them. And if you socialize with them, drink with them, eat with them, and have fun with them, you're far more likely to see them as a friend and someone you don't want to seriously challenge than as someone who you see as an opponent. I'm not saying you should see a politician as an enemy, but you should see him or her as someone that you seriously challenge. And that kind of dinner, which got a lot of press around the world, shows that kind of incestuousness that I think is one of the main reasons why so much of the corporate press is increasingly not respected or trusted by the vast majority of the population in the Western world.
Now, let's talk about some of the things that WikiLeaks has made available to the public. And it seems to me you can't really have a democracy if you don't have people who know what's going on, can you?
No.
Let's start with Guantanamo. That's particularly...
One of the revealing things about Guantanamo Bay, and most of these revelations happened before WikiLeaks became very, very well known, were the rules and regulations imposed by the then Bush administration on how prisoners should be treated at Guantanamo Bay. And, of course, we shouldn't forget that when Obama came in early 2009, he pledged that Guantanamo Bay would be closed. Well, we shouldn't forget that Guantanamo Bay, in fact, has remained open, and Obama has instituted military tribunals, which is respected by no other countries in the world, no other democracies in the world. So what WikiLeaks revealed were the kind of two things. One, the great deal of mistreatment that the U.S. was dealing out to alleged terrorists, so to speak, in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. And secondly, the kind of insane bureaucratic rules and regulations that were allowed to happen against prisoners. And an important part about this was that there were numerous evidences revealed by WikiLeaks of how U.S. officials, both in Washington but also soldiers down in Guantanamo Bay itself, willfully hid information from visiting officials from other institutions, for example, the Red Cross, who were allowed to visit prisoners at Guantanamo Bay but were never allowed to say anything about it publicly. This is one of the rules that the Red Cross institutes on itself, the idea being that the Red Cross is able to have more influence if it doesn't actually publicly criticize governments or institutions. But the fact is that WikiLeaks revealed that, in fact, the U.S. was hiding certain information, including certain prisoners, from the Red Cross. Now, you would think when that kind of information would be released, it would be a massive scandal. Officials would fall on their sword, there'd be charges. None of that happened. The information came out. It certainly got a bit of press for a few days, but that was all. And this, of course, has been the case in many examples of WikiLeaks. And I think that reveals not so much about WikiLeaks itself, but more about the political system that exists in much of the West, including the US, where accountability for those in power, for the elites, doesn't really actually exist at all.
I think that's one of the things that shocked Assange, because when they released some of the Fallujah information, and they found that nothing was happening. Of course, he has to turn everything over to, or WikiLeaks turns everything over to newspapers, doesn't it? So it gives the newspaper the power to decide.
I'll explain this briefly. WikiLeaks, when it first started in 2006, had a policy of primarily releasing information only on its website. Obviously, as time went on, that website became more well-known, received more traffic, etc. It did occasionally, increasingly, send information to various newspapers, media organizations, etc. The reason Julian Assange changed that policy a few years ago by partnering with the New York Times, the Guardian, etc., when they released the Afghan war logs, the Iraq war logs, which, for those who don't remember, was a massive treasure trove of information, internal documents by the U.S., which detailed countless deaths, civilian deaths caused by the U.S. in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and lots of other information about the war that the public did not know about. The reason Assange partnered with major media organizations in the U.S., the U.K., and parts of Europe was he felt, and I understand that feeling, that he wanted the information to get massive traction and realized that despite the fact that the alternative independent media is growing, the mainstream press still has a great deal of influence and power, so therefore it made sense to partner with them. Again, to cut a long story short, those relationships collapsed badly between WikiLeaks and the mainstream press, where both sides regarded the other with distrust over time. And now, by 2012, WikiLeaks does have many partnerships with much of the media around the world, but not organizations like the New York Times or the Guardian, who in the end, in many ways, put Julian Assange out to dry. And didn't, in my view, and certainly WikiLeaks' view, treat Assange and the information that they were getting from him with the respect it deserved.
It's in the military side, the embedded journalists seem to me to do a tremendous amount of harm in Iraq by sort of hiding the truth from the American public.
Well, the whole embedding process is a really interesting one, isn't it? Because it started, in many ways, over 100 years ago. A lot of the US and British military realized the advantage in taking journalists and reporters to the front line, almost using soldiers to protect them. And the result of that back then was that journalists routinely only published what the military allowed them to publish, because, of course, this is before the age of the internet, where it's much more difficult now to hide information. But also, they were more sympathetic to the government's view. Fast forward to 9/11, and the aftermath of 9/11, the Afghan wars and the Iraq war, and the U.S. under the Bush administration, Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, massively expanded the embedding process. Now, there's no doubt that some journalists who were embedded have done some good work. This is true, but, and this is an important caveat to that, the vast majority of that work has undoubtedly been very narrow, because the only things that you actually see as an embedded journalist is what the media want you to see, what the military want you to see. And secondly, you often have an agreement when you go on an embed that you aren't allowed to report information that is going to be too profoundly embarrassing to the military itself. So, yes, it is one version of the war. I don't think it should be ignored, because obviously it's not an irrelevant part of how a military sees the war, but the vast, more important part of the war is how it affects civilians, and that, of course, is generally not seen by an embedding process. And for example, just quickly, I was in Afghanistan recently looking at the issue of private militias, private security, private intelligence. And I chose not to be embedded, mainly because I felt that as an independent journalist, the view I wanted to get would be far more open by being independent, speaking to who I wanted to speak to, going where I wanted to go. The only real advantage of being an embed journalist is that you get access to certain places which you can't get any other way. There's vast areas of Afghanistan now where individually you simply can't go safely. There's no way to get there on your own. There's just no way, because you'll be captured, killed by the Taliban, insurgents, whatever. Now, the military, of course, protects you to an extent. They're, of course, also a danger, because militants attack them because they're occupying their country. But that's the only reason I would see why there are certain areas in the country where you would be embedded to get at least one perspective about the war.
So one of the information that WikiLeaks is making public, it's doing it through a Lebanese newspaper now, isn't it? That although the West can talk about withdrawing from Afghanistan, they're really just privatizing the fight and the intelligence collection.
Well, one of the things that we've seen in Iraq since the Obama administration came in was a propaganda line that says that the U.S. has now left Iraq and Iraq is an independent nation. Well, that's not really the case. There's no doubt that there are has been a removal of U.S. combat forces from Iraq. That's true. But what happened in Iraq, and what I think is going to happen in Afghanistan as well, is going to be it's a rebranding of the occupation. So you have in Iraq at the moment around 20,000 U.S. contractors. They aren't all mercenaries. Many of them are contractors. Some of them might be cooks, chefs. Some of them could be simply providing services. But also we have something called military trainers, who essentially are embedded with the Iraqi military to train them to supposedly at least be, well, adequate, but the idea, of course, is to be U.S.-friendly or Western-friendly. What Iraq did not allow, despite the U.S. putting massive pressure on it to do so, was to sign a long-term agreement with the U.S. to maintain some kind of presence in that country. So the contractors who are there are there because the Iraqi government is weak and doesn't have the power to tell them to bugger off, basically. Afghanistan is going to be a different case. And in fact, just today we heard that the Obama administration, in fact, President Obama is in Kabul at the moment as we speak, signing an agreement, a special forces agreement that will allow the U.S. to maintain a presence in Afghanistan for 10 years after 2014, when the U.S. and the West has pledged to leave the country, but essentially they're leaving, but in fact they're staying. So what will happen is that, yes, many of the Western forces will leave, that's true, but there'll still be an ongoing presence. Now, it's going to be framed, and it's already being framed by the US and Australia and other countries as having some kind of protection force to protect Afghanistan. What it actually means, though, is that the Afghan government, which is incredibly weak, that has no real power outside Kabul, which is profoundly corrupt, which has no legitimacy, which most people I spoke to don't respect, and the West has profoundly empowered the warlords, the worst aspects of the Afghan society, but the US and other Western forces will maintain a foothold in that country militarily and will have the ability and power to still use US special forces and others to what they would call conduct counterterrorism offensives. What, of course, that does do, though, and I heard that when I was there and I saw it myself, was it causes a great deal of anger and resentment in Afghanistan by the Afghan people themselves, because they say, well, we aren't an independent sovereign nation when a occupying force has the power to essentially go where it wants in our country, and we have a central government that allows that to happen. So the privatization of that war, which has been happening since 9/11, has only got worse, and I fear, as has happened in Iraq, that's going to only get worse after 2014.
You're listening to Earthwise on Plains FM 96.9. This evening's guest is Australian writer and investigative journalist Anthony Loewenstein.
Well, Anthony, I think we need to... Well, I'd also like to bring up the what's called in Julian Assange's book, Collateral Murder, the Apache gunship incident in July of 2007. This brings in Bradley Manning, doesn't it?
Well, the Collateral Murder video... for those listeners who don't know, was a clip that WikiLeaks obtained that was released a few years ago now, which essentially showed a U.S. helicopter gunship firing on an area of Baghdad, killing, I think it was 15 civilians, I'd have to check that to be sure, but killing a number of Iraqi civilians. The U.S., of course, claimed that they were killing terrorists or insurgents, but in fact, they were all innocent civilians, including two Reuters journalists. And when this footage was released a few years ago by WikiLeaks, it caused a storm. However, and this of course is the important however, no charges were ever laid against anybody who killed anybody in that incident. You did find a couple of US soldiers who came out after the video was released and said, we weren't the ones actually doing the firing, but we were the ones who went to the scene afterwards, and we saw the carnage that was created by the US, and we were the ones who were carrying dead Iraqi children or very injured Iraqi children to try and save them. And we profoundly apologised for being occupiers and doing that. Now, the people who did that, in my view, in the system that exists, are very brave individuals. Now, you could argue they should be charged for war crimes, but the individuals who came out and said that weren't the ones who were actually doing the killing per se. They were the ones who rushed to the scene afterwards to try and assess what had happened. And those US soldiers or former US soldiers who came out and spoke publicly, what they had seen, what they had done, in my view, are courageous individuals, because the US military system as it exists, there is no will whatsoever to actually really press charges against anybody. The only individuals since the Iraq War has started who have ever been charged and found guilty were low-level individuals, low-level soldiers who, yes, have committed war crimes and they should be punished for that. But the issue, of course, goes far higher than that, and that's the case in Afghanistan as well. But whenever something happens, like a collateral murder, or you hear about, as listeners will remember a few months ago, a US soldier in Afghanistan who eventually killed 17 civilians in a village near Kandahar, we're always told they're rogue soldiers, these are bad apples. The truth of the matter is the occupation in these countries and the brutalization of the war causes these incidents to happen and makes them normalized. We saw this in Vietnam as well, where when the My Lai massacre in the late 60s was exposed, it was said to be a rogue group of soldiers who committed war crimes. In fact, many soldiers at the time in Vietnam, both during the war and more importantly after the war, said in fact that those incidents were routine. That's simply how the war was conducted by the US. And in Iraq and Afghanistan, exactly the same thing has happened. So the revelation of WikiLeaks in collateral murder was important, but again, the fundamental problem still exists, that the political and media elites are allowing the senior elements of the political echelon, presidents, defense secretaries, military heads, to not be prosecuted. And that's, of course, why many, many individuals argue that international law at the moment as it exists, in fact, is really an imperial project. What I mean by that, international law is a vitally important tool, but if you look at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, which just last week found Charles Taylor, the former head of Liberia, to be guilty of crimes against humanity, an awful human being who deserves to be in jail. The individuals who are always put up in those trials are always from weak African, mostly African nations. Not only, but mostly. You never, ever see Western leaders, Western officials in those institutions. And until that happens, and I fear we're a long way away from that happening, international law, international justice will be seen by the vast bulk of the world as only justice for countries and individuals that the West no longer likes. And that, I think, is a profound problem.
Well, Anthony, you know, there's an old saying, if you don't like the message, you shoot the messenger. I think Julian Assange always knew that this would happen, but he must be shocked the way the reaction of the power base towards him. Is he in danger?
Are you saying against Julian Assange particularly?
Is he in danger now? I mean, it seems to me the attention of the world is being drawn on him and not on what WikiLeaks is telling us.
Yes, well, that's very clearly been a clear strategy for a long time, that you play the man and you don't play the situation. There's no doubt at the moment, as listeners will be aware, that Assange has been fighting for now well over a year extradition. He's currently living in Britain, extradition to Sweden to face sexual assault charges. Now, the validity of those charges are seriously questionable, and without wishing to go into great detail about them, it is virtually unprecedented to have an individual like Assange who has not been charged with any crime, let's make that very, very clear, has been charged with no crime, who has been under house arrest, who wears a monitor, who must see a police station once a day for over 500 days in Britain, waiting for a decision whether he should, or he's fighting to extradition to Sweden. The reason he is fighting that extradition, it's not because he doesn't think he should face justice or face a trial for sexual assault charges. Anyone, no one is above the law. The real concern is that particularly since 9/11, Sweden and the US have been disturbingly close. And there's been a couple of cases where the Swedish authorities have allowed extraordinary rendition, which essentially is a process whereby individuals are sent to a third country, often to be tortured or questioned under severe duress to get information. But the fear is that if Assange arrives in Sweden, the US is desperate to get Assange to the US to face a range of possible charges, allegations. And Assange fears that if he gets sent to Sweden, the Swedes will sign some secret deal with the US and he'll end up in a US prison. If that happens, he's in a very, very bad place for a very, very long time. And as we've seen at the moment, in the last year or so, Bradley Manning, who is the US soldier who allegedly sent information to WikiLeaks, and that, of course, has not been proven in a court of law yet, who was under extremely harsh conditions that were classed as torture by many individuals and legal experts in the US, was in solitary confinement. He's a young army private who was in Iraq, this is as the story goes, who was profoundly disturbed by what he saw in Iraq and what he saw with what the US was doing in its so-called war on terror post 9/11, and sent massive amounts of information to WikiLeaks that WikiLeaks then released. Now, in my view, and many people's view, what Bradley Manning has done, allegedly done, is the work of a hero. It's exactly what Daniel Ellsberg did many years ago with the Pentagon Papers, that an individual in a position of power sees a profound misuse of power, an abuse of power, and that's what Bradley Manning allegedly saw. Now, Manning's trial, which is going to start sometime this year, is likely to be a bit of a farce. And the fear is that although he won't face the death penalty, which initially was a possibility, he will face jail for the rest of his natural life for a hell of a long time. The guy is only 25. He's a very young guy. And the fear is that if Assange gets sent to the US, he will face similar charges as well, aiding the enemy. That is the main charge against Bradley Manning, that he was aiding and abetting the enemy. The enemy, in this case, being Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, whoever you want to say. But the whole issue here with Manning and Assange by the US is very clear. This is an attempt at payback. It's an attempt to say to individuals or institutions, if you screw with us, if you try to embarrass us, if you try to shame us, if you try to release information we don't approve of, we will punish you. And there's an attempt, and I would argue a failed attempt, to try and convince people that if you speak out of turn or release information, that we will punish you. And I think of the massive groundswell of support against the US for doing that, I think, has shown how information in a modern internet age cannot be controlled like it was in the past. That, yes, vast majority of information that is sent around the world is not read by the public, this is true. But WikiLeaks, I think, has shown, in my view, which is why I said at the beginning, in one of the most important acts, I think, certainly in the last decade, if not longer, is that all it takes is a few individuals to see acts that they see as wrong or illegal, and it can be released and disseminated, this is the important part, disseminated so fast by the internet or by various sources around the world, by social media, whatever it may be. And I think the effect of that has never really been accepted by many of those in power. And secondly, that there are now growing attempts in many countries, including in the West, not just in places like China and Iran, to increasingly censor the internet. And I think one of the reasons that many governments are trying to do that, although they talk about protecting society, is actually an attempt to try and manage information at a time where increasingly governments can't do so as well anymore as they used to.
I'm afraid we're going to have to interrupt you now, Anthony. It's been a fascinating discussion. And he's written some very interesting books, too. He was in New Zealand...
2 years ago.
3 years ago?
Two years ago,
promoted his book, My Israel Question.
Yeah. And the latest... had a wonderful time.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Anthony.
Thank you.
Thank you.